Hello, welcome to another of the DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast sessions. I'm Nikki Fairbairn. I'm a partner in the real estate team here. And in this episode, I'm going to be talking to Andrew Morgan, who is a partner in our planning team. And we're going to be talking a little bit about biodiversity net gain, which we've heard a lot about in the last few months. But Andrew, I'm hoping you're going to provide us with a lot more information, or certainly with me with more information. I'm going to start with a very generic question, though, which is, I suppose, let's start at the beginning. What is biodiversity net gain?
Well, biodiversity net gain has actually been a long time in the offing. It's now become a mandatory legislative statutory requirement incorporated into the planning regime by the Environment Act. And as of the 12th of February this year, it now is a requirement for all major developments to realise this is a relative 10% net gain in the biodiversity value of the land that's being developed. So what is it? I suppose really it is a requirement to see an enhancement in biodiversity value of land through land use redevelopment.
And it's obviously development focused. So what development does it actually affect?
Well, as of the mandatory introduction, the 12th of February, so all major development, and that includes housing-led development as well as commercial-led development. So, to give you an idea of what major is, typically 10 housing units in a scheme or more would be regarded as a major development, residential-led. And if we're looking at something in the commercial property sphere, 1,000 metres of floor space and above. So that's what's caught by the 12th of February mandatory introduction. It's really important to clarify that for smaller development, which is also subject to biodiversity net gain, that wasn't introduced until the 2nd of April, because it was important that the government staggered the introduction, because the exact mechanisms for how smaller development was going to be able to deal with the 10%, typically more constrained sites than 10 housing, 10 houses or 1,000 metres of commercial, it poses different challenges. And I think, with our discussion, we'll probably come on to how to deal with those challenges for constrained sites in off-site ways.
And so you mentioned the two dates there. Were those the only transitional arrangements, or was there anything else? Did all things change on the 12th of February and the 2nd of April, I suppose?
Well, for most of our clients, yes, they did. Applications for planning permission made after that 12th of February date, and then respectively for minor development after the 2nd of April date, would expect to be subject to a mandatory 10% requirement. So that is effectively kind of the line in the sand determining when planning applications are made, whether they will be subject to it. There are some exceptions to that, where, for example, you had an existing outline planning permission, and then, regardless of the 12th of February and the 2nd of April dates, you were then making applications for your detail part of the consent through reserved matters. Those wouldn't be caught because the planning permission was granted before that date. So even though you're actually almost kind of filling in the blanks of the precise composition of the scheme, you would not be caught. So that's one example in practice of how there is an effective transition.
And so that's an exception perhaps to the rule of the dates. I think generally, are there more exemptions to the BNG arrangements generally? There must be some schemes that have a little bit of flex to them perhaps?
Yes, I mean, I think, there's always a de minimis factor. So any development which is of a nature and size where it's not going to have any kind of meaningful impact on ecology, biodiversity value below a minor development, we might be talking about, let's say, a substation or a pumping station, an application for those things where they're not going to have any kind of meaningful impact, and they're obviously in that minor category, but where I think they would be able to bring themselves within that de minimis. And then also at the other end of the scale, of course, development proposals which are to do with the creation of biodiversity gain sites themselves, where works require planning permission in order to undertake significant, say, landscaping or regrading and planting, and per se particularly tree planting, in order to actually achieve the biodiversity purpose of an application. Those are inherently going to be immune from the requirement, which would obviously be perverse because they are actually delivering it for somebody else.
Any further gain. And I mean, biodiversity gain by its very nature, and you've used this word a few times, it looks at the biodiversity value of sites. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what that value is and how I suppose it might be calculated?
Yes, well, the first thing to say about understanding the value is that obviously as lawyers, you know, we're able to advise our clients about the regulatory and compliance regime, but what we are not as well versed in at all is the currency. And basically biodiversity net gain is measured in net gain units. And I think the best way I've had it explained to me by some ecologists and landscape architects is almost like top trumps. So you've got a baseline position, which is the biodiversity value of an existing piece of land. So let's say if it was just hard standing and concrete, it's almost going to be nil. And so your 10% needs to be found by not just relative increase, but naught to 10%, if you like. And the currency of those units is measured, as I mentioned, those kind of top trumps way, where open grassland is worth so much to actually go to your score. Tree planting is worth significantly more. And mature trees beyond saplings is worth even more than that. Meadowland is worth even more than that. And so that's why I'm kind of I'm thinking about it in terms of the, a deck of different landscape and biodiversity cards that you can play to give you what you need to get to 10%.
And am I right in thinking that you also look at sort of the specifics of the site, I suppose, as well, because it is going to depend on certain things such as size or location? I mean, presumably it's very subjective, I guess, is it?
Entirely subjective, because it's what is necessary to achieve a relative 10% score for the piece of land in question. So there isn't going to be a one size fits all here. The nature of the hard standing that I mentioned, which might be redeveloped and then have various landscaping and other features incorporated into it to give it its score. How that goes about that 10% and how easily it can achieve 10% includes not only issues of introducing that green space and the planting that's required, but even down to the relationship, the nature of the things that you're planting and the relationship that those things have to perhaps other nearby areas. You create synergies, and so there is not only within the piece of land that you're concerned with the consideration of the value of the things that you're deploying. There is the greater than the sum of their parts issue of a hierarchy of BNG, where you're planting something perhaps that has kind of segues or flora and fauna relationships with existing sites.
And you've talked about planting trees, for example. You don't just plant a tree and then walk off into the sunset, do you? Think BNG is a commitment for a period of time, isn't it?
That's right. The minimum statutory requirement is 30 years. So that's the government's kind of opener, if you like, as is the 10%. But in terms of the duration of the obligation, the need to put in place legacy arrangements is key to delivering and sustaining the score. The important thing is that 10% score has to be sustained for at least 30 years. And when we're thinking about what that kind of compliance looks like, it's often falling to managing agents, running estate management and stewardship operations for residential-led as well as commercial estates. And it's particularly important, this idea of 30 years, where if off-site solutions, we may come on to that, if off-site solutions are required to give you your overall 10% because you are constrained with what you can achieve within your own piece of land, then relying on the off-site solution and that it's going to be there to give you what you need for that 30 years and perhaps beyond becomes very, very important, because then you're in the hands of potential third parties who may default on executing a biodiversity gain plan to achieve that value.
And I suppose default, or rather, if we look at it positively, compliance is something that is of interest to the enforcement agencies, I guess. So how is BNG and the obligations that go with it, how is it actually secured, that compliance and that enforcement?
In the first instance, every planning permission for development that's caught by biodiversity net gain, it will be deemed at statutory level to be subject to a planning condition which will require, before the commencement of the development, the submission of a biodiversity gain plan, which is to tell the local authority, well, what developer, landowner are you going to do to actually achieve your score? That plan could then be could translated into other enforceable mechanisms, such as planning obligations. We're quite accustomed to obligations that sit within Section 106 agreements, obligations that are necessary to make a development acceptable in planning terms. And that's a natural place if you're going to be required within an on-site situation to do certain things in order to hit your score. A Section 106 agreement that attaches to the development is then a ready-made mechanism, and that is enforceable in the usual way by the local planning authority. So in the event of any kind of breach of the delivery of a biodiversity gain plan, the local authority has its enforcement rights, typically injunction, to make sure that things are happening as they should. But new animals have come along as well, because it's Section 106 agreements are there to support the grant of planning permission. So if you're in a situation where your development is actually the biodiversity gain site itself, and Section 106 isn't really relevant because you're not having to mitigate anything outside of your site, then conservation covenants, which is effectively a form of BNG Section 106 agreement, essentially a deed of covenant with the local authority to say, I am going to fulfill the requirements of the BNG plan, and this is what that looks like. A conservation covenant will often have attached to it the detail of the management regime that's required to actually create the value on the site, and in a similar way to Section 106 agreements, the deeds are enforceable by the local planning authorities.
And is there any chance in that case, because obviously you're committing to these on, well, fairly early on, pretty much day one, can you go back? Can they be varied? Can they be amended once the commitments have been made as a planning condition or otherwise?
There's no reneging on the compliance. I think how you go about achieving your score has some flexibility in it. There will be an opportunity to, let's take the example of large multi-phase developments as they come forward. The government has recognised in guidance that it's appropriate for compliance with that condition that I mentioned, that for large schemes where you're not going to have all the answers on day one about how 10% on a very large scheme that may take 10, 15 years to build out, let's say, particularly the case with large housing schemes, that there is some fluidity to how you're going to achieve your 10%. And so a large proportion of that might be on site, but also, as I say, you're not going to have all the answers from the outset. So your plan that you agree to allow the development to commence may include commitments to achieve certain parts of the score with off-site solutions, but it may not be that you've identified exactly what those solutions are at the outset. But as you consume your way through the scheme and deliver, then that specificity is then kind of built in, because you will then be able to submit through your biodiversity phase plan, which is a way that allows the local authority to then test and make sure that your overall solution is real. They can then require the developer to be specific down to, well, where are you acquiring these credits, what value, And we need to satisfy ourselves that the arrangements that you're relying upon are robust.
And 10% is, well, 10% is the figure. It's a mandatory figure. You've mentioned that a few times. I'm probably guessing you can't deliver less than 10%, therefore, can you?
Not anymore. I think where we can go is higher than that, because 10% is a figure that's been chosen by the government to strike a balance, to make a meaningful improvement, enhancement in biodiversity. So now that 10% is you know, the minimum requirement, the direction of travel is only really where the local authorities are going to be more demanding, whether they, in their areas, are going to set that bar higher, and how much higher than 10% is actually going to be achievable. Because you do start to, when you increase that score, you start to put very different commercial pressures on schemes, where land control, cost, pricing off-site solutions becomes quite onerous. So there are certain areas of the country already which are being more ambitious about the level of BNG to be achieved. And at some places it goes as high as 25%, which I think if you're a developer landowner trying to business plan for the cost of compliance, obviously there's a huge difference between 10% and 25%, and what that looks like in terms of compliance.
And I suppose that's a good point, actually, and maybe this is something to end on, which is a lot of people will be thinking, okay, so I know what BNG is, I know perhaps how I might go about getting it, but what should I actually be doing now? And I suppose that comment applies to landowners and developers, but also you mentioned before estate managers are going to start getting involved in the delivery. What I suppose would be your takeaways for landowners, developers and estate managers about BNG? What should they be doing now?
Legacy arrangements are really going to be the key. To support development, we now already know that BNG compliance has a legal implication to it in actually securing those arrangements. There is advice to be taken from landscape architects and ecologists to actually advise on what is going to be necessary to achieve the score. And I think that's obviously important in terms of securing planning permission, but I think the takeaways really are for the more challenging questions are where you had perhaps strategic landowners and developers who have taken positions already on pieces of land at a time that significantly predates any kind of understanding about the BNG regime that we now have. What do you do if you're already in a contractual situation which only recognised a standard regime of planning obligations and infrastructure costs? Do you have the opportunity to revisit from a deliverability, a cost control perspective, that situation in order to allow you to now take forward or bring forward land for the development that you intended, because the environment literally has changed there. So I think understanding your portfolio and your land control is key. Taking advice on how you give yourself control over offsite solutions and becoming au fait with sale and purchase BNG credit arrangements is going to be very important, because a lot of developments, and this is particularly true of perhaps more urban regeneration schemes, where yes, it's relative, but depending upon the local authority's aspirations for the score, it may be that off-site solutions are, for many schemes, the only way to actually hit the overall policy requirement if it goes above the 10% mandatory. And so I think understanding the regime of off-site solutions is going to be important for a lot of people.
That's great, Andrew. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us a little bit more about BNG. It's obviously going to be a very active time for this, for developers, for landowners and for estate managers, as you've said. I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions coming out of it as well. But just a quick thank you again for taking the time. Thank you to the audience for joining us again for another of our podcasts. And we will be back again for another one soon. Thank you very much to all listening.
Thank you.